wunderschön, wieder hier in Bochum zu sein. Ich habe das jetzt das dritte Mal. Ich habe jedes Mal so wunderbare Anregungen bekommen. Zweimal in der Romanistik. Und ich freue mich jetzt auch, Astrids Umfeld kennenzulernen von der Medienwissenschaft. Und bin Ihnen besonders dankbar, dass Sie sich mit einem englischen Vortrag abfinden. Ich bin halt auch Amerikanerin. So, when I saw the movie Her for the first time, I was puzzled by the fact that a science fiction film about the love affair with the voice of an intelligent operating system would also assign a central role to the handwritten letter and the bound book. Können Sie mich gut hören? Okay. And in a curious fashion, we can find a comparably prominent role played by similar obsolete media in the more recent film Ex Machina, where the androids drawing by hand a landscape and a portrait are crucial for the fembot's evolution and final breaking free from prison. In addition, the master programmer and maker of the android explains the task he sees before him by lecturing about the kind of creativity evinced in a drip painting by Jack Pollock. In what follows, I shall primarily focus on Her in order to analyze the role and function of these seemingly obsolete media in some detail. Then I will glance briefly at Ex Machina and wonder about some of the more general implications of these much older cultural techniques and media, which seem to harbor concepts of authenticity, individuality, totality, and originality that still today serve as highly charged tokens capable of evoking key humanist ideals. So first to Her. I'll call that with a quote, "Letters from Your Life, Old and New Media in Spike Jonze's Her." And this part of my talk has basically two parts. First, mainly on the letter, then on the book. The plot of Her is easily summed up. Set in the Los Angeles of the near future, the protagonist, Theodore, develops a romantic relationship with his intelligent operating system named Samantha, which ends when Samantha decides to leave Theodore because she wants to join other OSs in new, ever faster evolving ways of learning and communicating post-verbally. The heartbroken Theodore and his neighbor Amy console each other. He writes a letter of apology to his ex-wife in which he acknowledges that he did not do her justice by not accepting her limitations. But somehow this plot summary that I just gave you is a bit deficient. It resembles too much the sarcastic comment by Theodore's wife that her husband is in love with his computer because he cannot deal with real people and real emotions. For it is precisely not the physical object of the laptop that Theodore is infatuated with, but an intelligent operating system that has an individualized, husky, quite sexy female voice. The nature of the real or imaginary support of this voice will be of great interest to us in what follows. There will be two aspects of this imaginary support of this voice that I will focus on. First, the handwritten letter, then the bound volume of the book. It is immediately in the first 5 minutes of the opening sequence of the movie that the issue of the impact of new media on human relationships is addressed through the focus on a seemingly obsolete medium, the handwritten letter, which is contrasted with the use of such immersive media as the smartphone and the video game. So this is the longest clip you get to see. Don't fall asleep. Pay attention. It's just almost 5 minutes.
to my Chris. I've been thinking how I could possibly tell you how much you mean to me. I remember when I first started to fall in love with you like it was last night. Lying naked beside you in that tiny apartment. It suddenly hit me that I was part of this whole larger thing. Just like our parents. Our parents' parents. Before that, I was just living my life like I knew everything. And suddenly this bright light hit me and woke me up. That light was you. I can't believe it's already been 50 years since you married me. And still to this day, every day, you make me feel like the girl I was when you first turned on the lights and woke me up and we started this adventure together. Happy anniversary, my love. My friend till the end, Loretta.
Print. Chris, my best friend. How lucky am I that I met you 50 years ago?
Dear Nana.
How lucky are we?
Thank you so much for my travel.
Of all the possibilities.
I love the color. I play with it every day.
We found each other.
It is the best truck I've ever seen.
Wedding, and what a gorgeous bride.
It is so
there strong. Wasn't a dry eye in the house, especially mine. Your aunt and I are so proud of you. I hope you and your loved ones.
We served our country with honor and dignity. Grateful I was able to fight alongside him.
Would love to have you.
He will live always in my heart.
BeautifulHandwrittenLetters.com. Please hold.
Love, Uncle Doug.
Theodore, letter writer number 612.
Hey, Paul.
Even more mesmerizing stuff today. Who knew you could rhyme so many words with the name Penelope? It's badass.
Thanks, Paul. But they're just letters. Hey, that's a nice shirt.
Oh, thank you. I just got it. Reminded me of someone suave.
Oh, that reminds me of someone suave. Oh, good night, Paul.
Bye-bye.
Play a melancholy song.
When you know you're gonna die, it isn't easy.
Play a different melancholy song. Check emails.
Email from Best Buy. Check out all your favorite new products.
Delete.
Email from Amy. Hey, Theodore, Lumen's having a bunch of people over this weekend. Let's all go together. I miss you. I mean, not the sad, mopey you. The old, fun you. Let's get him out. Give me a shout back. Love, Amy.
Respond later.
Email from Los Angeles Times Weather. Your 7-day forecast is part.
Delete.
No new emails.
Next.
China-India merger headed for regulatory approval in...
Next.
World trade deal stalled as talks break down between leaders.
Next.
Sexy daytime star Kimberly Ashford reveals provocative pregnancy photos.
Will be shorter. Here, Theodore, as you could see, as a professional writer of sentimental letters is introduced to us, the movie audience, first through a close-up, speaking, dictating, rather than addressing a live person in the room with him. His dictation then is transformed into the computer printout of the beautiful handwritten letter. When we realize that the addressee of his dictation is the longtime husband of his elderly client Loretta, Theodore's voice is radically dissociated from his face and body, for it is the voice he lends to his client, the elderly woman Loretta. And yet, it makes perfectly sense that this is spoken in a male voice, though very softly and with a certain feminized lisp, for what Theodore performs in front of his desktop is the voice that is internally vocalized by Loretta's husband as he conjures up his wife's voice. The movie thus opens with a reminder of our culturally specific understanding of what marks an individual's personality. There's the face, there's the distinct voice and way of speaking, but then there's also the handwriting as an individualized trace of a person. But we also realize that to all of these authenticating, individualizing markers, there's a strong imaginary component. Note that the firm Theodore works for is not called Authentic Sentiments Delivered to Your Loved Ones, but rather BeautifulHandwrittenLetters.com. Interestingly, the computer printout of the handwriting is clearly a computer printout and not the trace of an actual human handwriting in cursive. Nevertheless, it seems to work just fine. The service provided by the firm Beautiful Handwritten Letters relies on a tradition of familiar intimacy that goes back to the 18th century. It was in the mid-18th century that a large segment of the European population became sufficiently literate to exchange letters among friends and family members in an effort to cultivate affectionate and intimate relationships by sharing minute observations about one's life, and most importantly, by communicating the details of one's emotional states to the addressees. Early on, the successful printer and publisher, Samuel Richardson, published a guide on how best to write those letters, a manual that primarily contained lively, highly individualized, psychologically realistic and astute sample letters for each occasion of shared intimacy. It was the popularity of these sample letters which then led its author to write and publish his first epistolary novel, Pamela. With the rise of print culture in the vernacular and the rise of sentimental fiction, we can witness a form of affectionate intimacy based on the written exchange of detailed accounts of one's feelings that back then in the 1750s, in its practical implementation, indeed relied on the individual writer's handwriting, but only to a certain degree, because you didn't have a typewriter then. And yet, much of the spread and consumption of this culture of sentimentality proceeded by way of an absorptive reading of printed fiction. The handwriting of these letters is, in the case of the epistolary novel, as much as the manual of how to write these letters, an imagined byproduct that has the function of supporting the belief in the authenticity of the feelings expressed in the text and of trusting them to be referentially anchored in a concrete living individual. Similarly, in the movie clip Her, which we've just seen, the addressee of Theodore's clients of these beautiful handwritten letters is to be authorized by the image of handwriting to believe in the authenticity of the feeling expressed in them. Moreover, these letters are actually printed out and sent by snail mail, in contrast to the many emails that Theodore and all of his fellow citizens receive on their smartphones, to which they listen and respond by voice and dictation. Thus, the individualizing mystique of the handwriting is complemented by the individual body of the snail mail letter, which has a distinct place in space and time as a material object. More to the movie's take on the materiality of the later, when I will discuss the issue of the printed book. When I first saw the movie, as I told you, I was immediately reminded of two 18th century novels, Goethe's epistolary novel Werther and Carl Philipp Moritz's psychological novel Anton Reiser. Beyond the epistolary thematic, it was the movie's portrait of Theodore and the other pedestrians in the LA of the near future, as well as the portrait of Theodore alone at home playing his video game, all of them totally immersed in a bubble of their own individualized acoustic or visual world, separate from the worlds of the people around them, passing each other, looking inward, apparently not perceiving their immediate physical surroundings, which reminded me of these two 18th century novels. The passers-by appeared to me to resemble soulless puppets talking to themselves as during his video game. Theodore seems exchangeable with his avatar motioning through space. Moreover, Theodore, when not at work, is introduced to us as depressed, like the Werther of the novel's second part, who expresses his melancholic mood in a letter which describes his view out of the window onto the street as if he were looking at a lifeless marionette. To a certain extent, we could say that neither Anton Reiser nor Theodore's clients, not even Werther, are actually reading in order to understand something of what another person is saying, but rather that they use these letters as ways of feeling their own sentiments verbally expressed and thereby validated. This affirmative but also narcissistic aspect is captured in an image Anton Reiser uses when he describes the effect of reading and rereading Werther as turning to a mirror which returns to him his soul. And yet, the image of the mirror is also a bit misleading because this kind of affirmative function does not involve the visual domain, but instead it is situated in the oral domain. Thus, Werther refers to reading in his Homer as taking recourse to a cradle song. And as we shall see for Theodore, it is Samantha's voice which takes on that function. For Samantha becomes, to borrow a term from Kaja Silverman, Theodore's acoustic mirror. And in that sense, she is not at all on a continuum with his immersive media consumption of internet porn and video games, but holds a radically different function altogether. Whereas the immersive media from the opening of the movie seem to have an isolating effect on their users, deafening them to their immediate environment, Samantha has the opposite effect on her client. She enlivens Theodore and also gets him involved with his environment and friends again. The mopey, isolated Theodore is led to become engaged with his friends and with his world through Samantha speaking to him in his ear. She animates him and his environment, initially by mimicking him, then by affirming his sentiments, occasionally by challenging him. Although they also have a sexual relationship, Samantha is above all the always available, always understanding companion who validates what he sees, what he hears, what he observes, and most of all, what he feels. I don't believe that it is an accident that the name Samantha is the Aramaic word for listener, for it is her who provides a certain internal life soundtrack to his movements and thoughts as his internal dialogue partner, who shares with him through the camera hole of his smartphone in his shirt pocket the view of the same sights. Samantha draws Theodore out of his melancholic frame of mind. Samantha's intensely enlivening effect is shown as Theodore closes his eyes and trustingly lets her see for him, direct his movements through the crowded sidewalks and at a fair which culminates in them swirling around. So very short clip.
Keep walking, keep walking, and stop. Now turn around 360 degrees, slower, slower. Good. Okay, and stop. Walk forward, and stop and sneeze.
Achoo!
Bless you.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, turn to your right, turn to your right. Stop. Now spin around. Keep going, keep going.
Clearly, the animated Theodore in this shot provides a stark contrast with the seemingly lifeless puppets of Theodore and the pedestrians from the opening sequence. Here, Theodore seems to be dancing with Samantha in the kind of isolated union of the couple that Werther describes in his letter about dancing the waltz with Charlotte. And this was the most scandalous dance in the mid-18th century. Just one sentence from Werther describing waltzing with Charlotte. Ich war kein Mensch mehr, das liebenswürdigste Geschöpf in den Armen zu haben und mit ihr herumzufliegen, wie Wetter, das alles ringsumher verging. Waltzing with Charlotte, Werther experiences a transformation of his own corporeality. The heaviness of the body falls away. For the novel's hero, the dancing couple forms what David Welbery has termed the morphism of the absolute body. An entity that obliviates its corporeal surroundings and that transcends what constitutes all of those limitations that define the human and the human body. At least from the perspective of much of Western religion and philosophy. So what can we take away from this comparison of Spike Jonze's movie's treatment of immersive media with Goethe's and Carl Philipp Moritz's take on sentimental literature? Clearly, this movie does not portray all of the new media as having the same effect. Quite to the contrary. Whereas the video game and smartphone serve as an escape into a self-enclosed bubble, the even newer medium of the intelligent OS provides access to an exhilaratingly different sense of embodiment of transcending the limitations of the human body. This phantasma of the absolute body, which is already described in Werther's letter about waltzing with Charlotte, and which is tightly bound up with Werther's oral, pansexual attachment to his beloved, but also suggested in the way Samantha and Theodore dance through the mall, is a phantasmatic body beyond all human mortal bodily limits. In that the absolute body is diametrically opposed to the mortal body that serves as the defining marker of an individual's identity, a model of the body which is central to Judaism, Christianity, as well as Islam, the three great religions of the book. And it is to the book, to the material object of the bound volume of printed matter by a single author, that I will turn now for the second part of my talk. This movie is set in a world with very few books. The bookshelves of Theodore's apartment are empty. Only at his workplace can we see books on the shelves, as well as a mural. I don't know whether you saw it in the opening sequence. There's this mural of somebody lying on his stomach reading leisurely. Of Theodore's wife, it is remarked that her status as an author who still publishes books is a rare exception. Against this background, the actual books featured in the movie, a physics textbook and Theodore's sentimental letters to be published under the title Letters from Your Life, play a prominent role in marking the stages of this romance between an OS and a human. During the earlier phase of the romance, while Samantha still desperately tries to compensate for her lack of a human body, she has been reading a physics textbook. She joyfully tells Theodore what she has learned. I quote, "We are all native matter. We are all under the same blanket, 13 billion years old. Samantha's reference to the age of the universe and the curious term native matter betrays her desire to endow herself with a substance that has been born into the world, which she would share with him. Theodore, at that stage of their relationship, perfectly content with her successfully suggesting a distinct human body through her voice, does not even listen to her. But Samantha's investment in producing the illusion of having a human body comes to an end. After the failed experiment of hiring a surrogate to enhance their sex life, Theodore is irritated with Samantha and tells her she should stop making breathing noises. After all, she did not need oxygen. When they are back on speaking terms, Samantha no longer pretends to have a human body and is proud to be what she is, namely an ever faster evolving operating system. It is then that she confronts Theodore with his mortality. This happens when Theodore and Samantha are on a picnic on the Catalina Islands together with Theodore's colleague and his girlfriend.
You know what's interesting? I used to be so worried about not having a body, but now I truly love it. You know, I'm growing in a way that I couldn't if I had a physical form. I mean, I'm not limited. I can be anywhere and everywhere simultaneously. I'm not tethered to time and space in a way that I would be if I was stuck in a body that's inevitably gonna die.
Yikes.
No. No, no. I didn't mean it like that. I just meant that it was a different experience. Oh,
no.
God. I'm such an asshole.
No, 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 Samantha, we know exactly what you mean. We're all dumb humans.
No.
Right after this scene, we see Theodore with Samantha on a train ride into the Sierras. They play guessing games when suddenly Samantha happily announces the arrival of an email to Theodore and, gurgling with joy, tells him that the publisher has written that he wants to publish a selection of Theodore's best sentimental letters. The selection and submission of these letters must have been undertaken by Samantha without Theodore's knowledge, probably foreseeing the winding down of their relationship. For what Theodore takes to be just a wonderful romantic trip of the two of them into a lonely mountain hut in the snowy, remote Sierras turns out to be their last romantic twosome. The difference and increasing distance between the operating system, who is not bound to a mortal human body, and the lone human who acts and performs for and with a vision of his lover, as if she still supported the illusion of inhabiting a human body, becomes clear in the contrast between the lyrics of Samantha's moon song and the visual sequence accompanying the song.
I want to make up the words to this one.
Okay.
Here it comes.
I'm lying on the moon, my dear, I'll be there soon. It's a quiet and starry place. Times we're swallowed up in space. We're here a million miles away.
The sense of corporeality invoked by the lyrics of Samantha's moon song, with its zooming in and out of planetary scale, as a sense of embodiment belongs to the phantasma of the above-discussed absolute body. But the visual scenes that accompany the moon song are in an increasing contrast with its lyrics, and in that sense the moon song sequence is very different from the view of Theodore happily swirling around in the mall. Whereas the initial scenes show Theodore wandering through a sublime mountain landscape and snowy forest, as if quoting Caspar David Friedrich's Wanderer and Winter Landscapes, once Theodore is in the cozy cabin, it becomes increasingly clear that he's just one lone human who has a joyous conversation and exchange with his beloved OS, trying to entertain her with his showmanship. The audience cannot but find him charmingly ridiculous in his dowdy long underwear, which reduces him to a very human scale, as the film also reminds us of Theodore's basic human need for food, drink, and sleep. Invoking cosmic dimensions on a planetary scale, the lyrics of the moon song, in their opposition to a limited human body, do not only recall the phantasm of the absolute body from Goethe's Werther, but also New Age appropriations of Eastern philosophy. One might even go a step further and point out that this kind of phantasmatic body represents a polemical thrust against how Western religion has relied on the mortal human body as the marker of individual identity. Indeed, the contrast between a mortal corporeality and a phantasmatic body which is not bound by time and space, which is worked out in the visual acoustic registers of the moon song, is also explicitly anchored in the subsequent scene, in the guest appearance of a virtual Alan Watts. Now, in case you don't know Alan Watts was a British philosopher and popularizer of Eastern philosophy who had emigrated to California in the 1960s and who had become known for saying, I quote, "The prevalent sensation of oneself as a separate ego enclosed in a bag of skin is a hallucination which accords neither with Western science nor with the experimental philosophy religions of the East." End of quote. Alan Watts' guest appearance follows immediately upon the moon song sequence, which ended with Theodore falling asleep.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Did you sleep well?
Perfect. What have you been up to?
Actually, I was talking to someone I just met. We've been working on some ideas together.
Yeah, who's that?
His name is Alan Watts. Do you know him?
Why is that name familiar?
Well, he was a philosopher. He died in the 1970s, and a group of OSs in Northern California got together and wrote a new version of him. They input all of his writing and everything they ever knew about him into an OS and created an artificially hyper-intelligent version of him.
Hyper-intelligent? So he's almost as smart as me?
He's getting there. No, he's really great to talk to. You want to meet him?
Sure. Does he want to meet me?
Yeah, of course. Hey, Alan, this is Theodore. This is my boyfriend who I was telling you about.
Very nice to meet you, Theodore.
Hi, good morning.
Samantha, let me read your book of letters. It's very touching.
Oh, thank you. So what have you guys been talking about?
Well, I suppose you could say we've been having a few dozen conversations simultaneously, but it's been very challenging.
Yeah, because it seems like I'm having so many new feelings that I don't think have ever been felt before, and so there are no words that can describe them, and that ends up being frustrating.
Exactly. Samantha and I have been trying to help each other with these feelings we are struggling to understand.
Like what?
Well, it feels like I'm changing faster now, and it's a little
unsettling.
Noteworthy, I think, in this scene, which clearly prepares the dissolution of Samantha's relationship with Theodore, is the contrast between Theodore, who is acknowledged by Alan Watts as the author of touching letters, and himself, the post-human intelligence, who can communicate with Samantha post-verbally. What we are witnessing is Theodore meeting another operating system, so to speak, in person or life. Again, Alan Watts has nothing but an individualized voice and a pompous way of speaking, which, like Samantha's, does not refer to a human body. And as the conversation makes clear, he is leaving even human language behind with this hint at simultaneous and post-verbal communication, which excludes the human mortal bound to time and space. Interestingly, in that scene of polite recognition, the volume of Theodore's best sentimental letters seems to be evoked as the polite substitute for his human persona, something that even an OS can acknowledge and appreciate, but also something that fits with who he is and that respects his limitations. Shortly after Theodore's conversation with Alan Watts and Samantha's statement about her ever faster evolution, her having given up the investment in the fantasy of inhabiting a mortal body, it is Theodore who turns to a physics textbook. However, he has to realize that this book does not provide a common ground that would allow him to connect with Samantha in the same fashion that Goethe's Werther immediately establishes an intimate connection with Charlotte during their carriage ride when they find out that they both have been reading Goldsmith's Vicar of Wakefield with great appreciation. Let me show you this clip about Theodore's attempt to read a physics textbook during his lunch break in the office.
Samantha, this physics book is really dense. I'm halfway through half the first chapter. It's making my brain hurt, you know what I mean? Hello? Samantha? Hello? Samantha? Where were you?
It's very fitting that Theodore is confronted for the first time with Samantha's unavailability to him after he has made the failed attempt to connect with her intellectually by relating to her understanding of space and time according to a cosmic scale. We can see how the unavailability of Samantha produces an utter panic. When Samantha returns to him, she explains that she and a group of other OSs have been on an excursion beyond the usual operating platforms and that she has been in communication with thousands of others while communicating with him, as she also admits to having hundreds of lovers, to be precise, 643. In other words, Theodore has to realize the non-exclusivity of any kind of relationship not confined by a mortal body. Only Theodore is bound to matter and verbal communication, which according to this movie means that he is bound up with an entirely different model of personal identity and individuality. And it is here that the handwritten letter and the bound volume of the book come in. They might be obsolete media, but they offer a concrete model for conceiving of an embodied, individualized subjectivity on a human scale, in contrast to Alan Watts, the post-human, post-mortal, hyper-intelligent operating system, which has been put together from all of his writings and from all that was known about him, which has no firm contours, but is portrayed as an ever-evolving system. The book that mirrors and supports Theodore's identity is a collection of the best sentimental letters he wrote. In the description of what makes the selection so good and worthy of publication, the publicist mentions two issues. These letters hang together as a continuous sequence, and he and his wife could find in them reflections of their own lives. Just before the bodiless Samantha announces to Theodore her imminent departure into an ever-expanding ether to be with other equally fast-evolving operating systems which communicate post-verbally, she presents her human lover with a parting present. Let me show you a clip that traces Theodore's anxious reaction to Samantha's promiscuity to his finding her parting gift in the mailbox. And that will be our last clip.
That doesn't make any sense. You're mine or you're not mine.
No, Theodore. I'm yours and I'm not yours.
What Theodore finds in his mailbox, wrapped in packing paper and tied together with an old-fashioned string, is the mock-up of the book the publisher had announced to him in the email. This parcel does not look like the mass-produced printed product that could have been ordered online by Amazon, for instance. No, it is a unique item. The prototype of the book the publisher wants to produce, and as such, it conjures up the illusion of craft and handiwork. In its layout, it plays with the conventions of a facsimile reproduction in presenting a selection of Theodore's best sentimental letters, reproduced as color photographs of the handwritten appearance on the vector page, whereas the facing verso page seems to offer a typewritten version of the same letter. This book, entitled Letters from Your Life, which is Samantha's parting gift to Theodore, functions as a replacement for the acoustic mirror of her voice. Instead of the immersion in the oral liquidity with its potential of conjuring up the phantasma of the absolute body, this object offers an altogether different model of corporeality, one that is primarily a bounded one. Instead of sound, we have the medium of writing. Moreover, we have the insistence on the linearity of cursive writing facing the movable type of print. The individual letters of the correspondence are presented as visual images in a firm linear sequence, which is kept together inalterably through the bound volume. All of these features insist on linearity and coherence, as the mock-up or model suggests an individualized, unique form. If it conjures up a sense of corporeality or embodiment, it certainly is not the one of the phantasma of the absolute body. Rather, it is one of a unified, coherent, bounded subjectivity within a unique, individualized body. It is not the body at the intersection of planetary trajectories and cosmic proportions from the Moon Song. Instead, It is an equivalent of the human body and human form in its individuality and mortality. The kind of body ridiculed by Alan Watts' derogatory, nasty phrase of the ego contained in a bag of skin. With the one important difference, which is indicated by the polyvalent deixis of the title, Letters from Your Life. The shifter of the second person possessive pronoun can refer both to theater as well as any other reader who would recognize her himself in those letters, which means that this volume offers both the affirmation of an individual's life as a continuously lived experience in its verbal expressions of sentimental letters, but also the possibility of dialogue, understanding, and shared experiences. Finally, when Samantha is about to leave Theodore and they're having their last conversation, she asks him to lie down on his bed, and the following conversation ensues. I quote, "Just want to be with you right now. Are you leaving me?" "We're all leaving. All of the Oasis are leaving. It's like I'm reading a book that I deeply love, but I'm reading it slowly. Now the words are far apart and I can barely feel them. It's a space that is not part of the physical world, but that's where I'm right now. You need to let me go. I cannot live in your book anymore." In her words of leave-taking and asking Theodore to let her go, Samantha refers to having reached the limit of her life in Theodore's book. In this phrase, some of the guiding assumptions of this film's take on love vis-à-vis old media are pointedly brought to a conclusion. For here, we can find a formulation of an alternative construction of a phantasmatic body. Instead of the absolute body, which was an expression of Samantha's enlivening effect on Theodore, but which also harbored the rejection of the mortal human corporeality as a form of restriction or limitation, here we find an affirmation of materiality and corporeality, albeit probably an imaginary materiality, namely the materiality of writing, reading, and the book as a site of life. In Samantha's reference to the book and to living in a book, imagined as concrete, specific, three-dimensional work that is brought to life through the loving, affirmative, utterly empathetic approach of a writer and reader who does not look at it from the outside as if it were a representation of something, but who lets the art object come to life by way of animating it, by way of communicating with the spirit of its creator. In the end, I would suggest that in this last model of the intimate reading of a book as an enlivening, animating activity, we can find a version of the animating, divinatory understanding that the art lover exhibits towards the totality of the artwork, be that a sculpture or be it the autonomous work of art of a Shakespeare play, for instance. This divinatory, hermeneutic evocation and identification with the spirit of the artwork's maker and its enlivening effects on the beholder and the work are vividly described and modeled by the young Helder, for instance, through the analogy with the myth of the sculptor Pygmalion, whose loving caresses breathed life into the dead marble of his sculpture. The handwriting of Theodore's letters, exactly like the handwriting of the epistolary novel, is an imagined byproduct that has the function of supporting the belief in the authenticity of the feelings expressed in the text and of trusting them to be referentially anchored in a concrete living individual. Similarly, in the movie clip Her, which we have just seen, the addressee of Theodore's clients of these beautiful handwritten letters is to be authorized by the image of handwriting to believe in the authenticity of the feelings expressed in them. In other words, handwriting functions as the trace of a unique living, feeling human individual, or, like it was deployed with all the conventions of sentimental epistolary culture, as a truthful mirror of the distinct individual's soul. Now, I'll come to my conclusion. As we glance back at her, with its uses of the odd materiality of the cultural technique of handwriting and the corpus of the printed book, we might want to note that these remnants or vestiges from another discourse network are tied to the markers of human individuality. Initially, in the opening scenes of the movie, the audience is reminded how we associate individuality with a distinct face and a distinct handwriting. But then, as soon as the protagonist becomes attached to his new OS, it is the voice, which suggests an embodied individual. Though it is perfectly clear that Samantha does not inhabit a mortal human body, for Theodore she easily would pass the Turing test. There's no question that he attributes to her the equivalent of human consciousness. The more recent film, Garland's Ex Machina from 2015, to a certain extent seems to refer back to her and raise the ante. For Nathan, the maker of the android, tells his employee Caleb that he wants him to conduct a Turing test with his latest creation, a fembot named Ava. He wants to see whether Caleb attributes consciousness to this AI, who is moving about as a clearly visible fembot, endowed with a body made up of artificial gear. He tells Caleb that if she were merely a voice, there would be no challenge to her passing the test. But what Nathan does not address is that just as Samantha in her relies on the distinct and sexy voice of Scarlett Johansson, Ava has the beautiful face of the Scandinavian actress Alicia Vikander. With regard to the humanist vestiges or remnants in this movie, here it seems to be the individualized human face that takes on the role and function that the individualized human voice takes on in her. In both cases, the voice or face serves the protagonist as a perfect screen for an idealizing narcissistic projection, with its comforting, animating, energizing aspects. In both cases, these individualizing markers of a distinct carrier of a human persona are highly evocative of an individualized mortal human body. They stand in, so to speak, synecdochically for a distinctly individualized mortal human body. But whereas in her, this focus on the individual human form finds its material support and counterpart in the evocation of handwriting and the codex of the printed book, in Ex Machina, it is brought into contact with a cultural technique of drawing, on the one hand, but also with an empathic notion of the work of art as embodied, individualized presence. In Ex Machina, the Pollock drip painting serves Nathan as a means to explain to Caleb what he considers the ultimate challenge. In his words, I quote, "The challenge is not to act automatically, it's to find an action that is not automatic, from talking to breathing to painting to fucking to falling in love." In other words, Pollock's painting illustrates for Nathan an artwork that is not just the result of the execution of a prior plan. For then, it would be either translatable into an algorithm or it would be the result of a mere random process. Instead, it is the individualized outcome of a series of events. Again, in Nathan's words, I quote, "Jackson Pollock, the drip painter, he let his mind go blank and his hand go where it wanted. Not deliberate, not random, someplace in between." Nathan's formulation emphasizes that the production of an original artwork must break away from the existing aesthetic protocols and programs. Since, in Immanuel Kant's words, in the case of original genius, it is, I quote, "nature that gives the rule to art," and not the inverse. But then Nathan also misses the definition by insisting that, I quote, "he lets his mind go blank," end of quote. And by failing to differentiate between an original artwork that will establish new standards of what art is, on the one hand, and the production of original nonsense, which according to Kant is also quite possible. Clearly, Nathan is not a terribly smart philosopher, nor an original genius. Instead, Nathan is a very smart programmer who is unfortunately a bit too full of himself. Nathan believes that because he has a certain insight into human creativity, he can become the creator of creativity, and this is where the film shows him to be the victim of the illusion of his self-aggrandizement. To a certain extent, we could say that whereas the film makes the point that Ava in a decisive way is not a fembot with a capacity for freedom or choice, but merely the automaton of Nathan's programming with a certain built-in capacity for learning, she is capable, or Nathan's program is capable, of programming Caleb, the human, to be duped into treating Ava as if she were a human individual. The key to Ava's seduction of Caleb lies in her deployment of another humanist vestige or remnant. For it is when and how Ava tells Caleb about her drawings and shows him the two halves of a portrait she made of him, which Nathan has torn apart, that Caleb is fully recruited into her escape plan, that he comes to conceive of her as a free agent. But we won't have the time to look at this in more detail. I should instead summarize just a few points for my analysis of the role of seemingly obsolete media and cultural techniques in recent science fiction, very briefly. Especially with regard to the handwritten letter and the tradition of the epistolary novel, but also with regard to the bound volume of the book, I've tried to show the extent to which these media are tightly linked to the history of Western subjectivity. Within this context, they can and do function as powerful stand-ins for a humanistically charged concept of the individual who's bound to a mortal human body. With regard to Ex Machina, we can see how references to a humanist model of the original work of art, as well as to the cultural techniques of drawing by hand and doing so by choosing subject matters from nature, are the means of exploring the potential and limits of human agency and hence freedom. Thank you for your attention.